Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. On the Who We Are page on the website of the Appalachian Research and Defense Fund, AppRED, the first thing you see is this sentence, providing free legal services to the low-income and vulnerable in eastern and south-central Kentucky, we do not charge. The Prestonsburg-based legal aid organization has been going to bat for scores of eastern Kentuckians for decades and is about to celebrate its 50th anniversary. Joining us from Prestonsburg is Robert Johns, AppRED Legal Aid Executive Director. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Rob.
Tom, thank you very much, and it's great to be with you.
Well, I had the great privilege of sitting down with AppRED founder John Rosenberg recently for a lengthy interview about his remarkable background, and I underscore remarkable, and the history of the organization, which is equally remarkable. And I hope to feature excerpts from that conversation very soon here on Eastern Standard. But for listeners who are not familiar with what AppRED does, I'd like to ask you to, as briefly as possible, spell it out for us. What do you guys do?
At AppRED, Tom, we have been fighting poverty and providing equal access to justice for folks struggling to make ends meet for 50 years, and we're celebrating our 50th anniversary, and we're very proud of that. We give people in our community the legal help they need to build a secure life for their families. I think it's important to mention that we handle only civil cases. We do not handle criminal cases. Those are handled by the Department of Public Advocacy. So we are civil legal aid. We are not the public defender. I think a good way to explain our work is that we focus on helping to make sure our clients have the basic necessities of life: food, shelter, income, healthcare, safety, and security. And we provide legal representation and help in a variety of ways. And when someone's family or health or home is on the line, we are right there with them so that they have a fair shot in court. And we help guide folks through these court proceedings, which can be very, very complicated.
If you had to put together a short list of the really big cases that AppRED has taken on over the years, and I know that's asking a lot of you, but what would, say, the top three be?
That is difficult to get that down to three. I can give you a list of a few more, Tom, that are really important and have had tremendous impact on our service area. A lot of important mine safety work and black lung benefits work. We're involved in saving Red River Gorge and protecting Robinson Forest. We defeated the broad form deed. We've been involved in obtaining rights for prisoners and in obtaining reforms against check cashing businesses. We were involved in litigation against the state parks and housing authorities for racial discrimination in their hiring practices. And we were involved in some of the first clinics for people with HIV and AIDS and for migrant farm workers in our service area.
Some of these cases have actually made it all the way to the Supreme Court, correct?
Yes, and that is before my time, but we have had some cases reach the Supreme Court, yes.
How many attorneys work with you, are they working pro bono? How does that work?
Tom, we have attorneys that are on staff, so this is their job to provide legal services to low-income and vulnerable folks. And at this point, we have 25 attorneys who are working in our 37 counties. We also have a pro bono program in which we involve private attorneys in providing services to our client population. And some of those cases are handled on reduced fee contracts, so attorneys are only paid a portion of what they would generally get paid to represent folks, and other cases are handled on a pro bono basis. Currently, we have about 50 private attorneys who volunteer for us across our 37-county service area, and we are very, very thankful for the work they do because they allow us to obviously help more people and expand our services, which is wonderful.
Well, obviously, you have a payroll to tend to, and in just a second, we're going to get around to an event coming up that will help with that matter. But before we get there, what are some of the legal issues that people in our region are facing now that you all are working on?
We are seeing a lot of people coming to us who are facing eviction. And for a family facing eviction, civil legal aid like us can be the difference between keeping their home or being forced out onto the street. And in one recent case, we helped stop an eviction for a client while she was sick with COVID and was in quarantine. And in another case recently, we helped stop an eviction so that a man could receive hospice care in his home and live out his last days with dignity. Many people have come to us during the pandemic because they have not received their unemployment benefits. The unemployment system was overwhelmed in Kentucky during the pandemic, and we have helped people navigate that system and get their benefits. We continue to help many survivors of domestic violence get emergency protective orders and get other wraparound support that can help them achieve safety and independence. We protect public benefits that are wrongly terminated or denied, from food stamps to black lung to disability. One example of our work in that area is with the victims of attorney Eric C. Kahn, who faced the loss of their Social Security and SSI benefits. We're awaiting new hearings for folks who lost in the first round and appealed their cases. Their cases have now been sent back to Social Security for a new hearing, and they got their benefits back while they were waiting. But after that, what is really ominous is that there is another second round of 2,000 folks facing redetermination hearings, and those are likely to start later this year or next year. And none of these folks in the first round or the second round participated or had anything to do with the fraud. And for many of them, this is their only income. So we're going to do everything we can to assist those folks at Apple Red, but obviously we're limited, and we're going to ask for help from the private attorneys who helped out before, but we're going to need more help. If there are private attorneys who are interested, we would love additional volunteers to be able to help more people as they face the loss of their benefits. We did have a little bit of good news in the Kahn cases. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit decided the Potter case, which held that some victims who had lost their benefits and did not appeal on time could use a special rule that expands the statute of limitations. So this will benefit some people who will now get a new hearing, and they'll also get their benefits back while they wait for that hearing. And so far, we think that that decision will help around 10 people that we're aware of, and maybe more. We've been doing also a lot of work in the area of expungements. We've recently helped someone who has been in recovery with an expungement, and they are now applying for truck driving positions. And that's really a great job. And with these expungements, we are trying to help support a lot of folks who have been impacted by the opioid crisis and help get them back to work and in the economy, and hopefully working toward better lives. So we're going to continue to be doing a lot of work in the future on expungements to give folks a second chance.
Well, Rob, what does someone who might be hearing us right now, who is in need of legal representation but can't afford it, what do they need to do to engage the services of Apple Red?
We have three ways that folks can get in contact with us to make an application for services. We have a hotline that we operate with our central intake unit, and the phone number for that is 866-277-5733. Folks can also walk into any one of our five offices, and our offices are in Prestonsburg, Hazard, Richmond, Barberville, and Somerset, and they can make an application in person. And the third way is they can apply online. We have an online application on our website, which is ardfky.org. And those any one of those three ways are a great way to apply for services, and their application then will be reviewed, and we will see what we can do to help them.
Well, you have basics like the light bill, and then you have the important part, the payroll, which is funding these attorneys who are making all of this happen, on your plate. And in support of that, you have an important event coming up soon that we mentioned earlier. Tell us about what is called Gather for Justice.
Well, Tom, we had hoped to celebrate our 50th anniversary with a fundraising dinner this year, but with the uncertainty of COVID, we decided instead to do a virtual event. We're going to try for an in-person event next year if we can do it. So our event is called Gather for Justice because that's what we'll be doing. As a community, we're getting together to support equal access to justice. There's a justice gap in this country because there are simply not enough resources to meet the civil legal needs of low-income people. Current funding meets only a fraction of that need, so justice is often limited by how much money you have. So when a person is facing, you know, issues with their family, with their health or health care, with their home, when those issues are on the line, they deserve legal help to have a fair shot in court. It is so critical that we can provide access to legal services for all who need them. So we will gather for justice, and this will take place on Saturday, September 18th at 7 o'clock by Zoom. And it's going to be a lot of fun. We're going to have your interview, as you mentioned, with John Rosenberg. We will have a mixologist who's going to help folks make their own bourbon drinks at home. We'll have some pop-up visits from Kentucky musicians Alex Miller, who appeared on American Idol, and The Voice winner Jordan Smith. We will also have former Applered attorney and fiddler Karen Jones join us for a song. It's free, and we invite everyone to attend to learn more about us and celebrate our 50th, and hopefully we'll raise some funds. And folks can register by going to our website at ardfky.org and clicking on Gather for Justice. And I wanted to mention there's a couple other ways folks can help out as well, Tom. We have an auction that we are running right now in conjunction with our Gather for Justice event, and it is live, and we have some very nice items to bid on with all proceeds going to Applered. And folks can find the link to the auction on our website. And we are also selling a 50th anniversary bourbon in cooperation with Bluegrass Distillers, and folks can purchase our bourbon directly from the Bluegrass Distillers website, and that link to their website is also available on our website. So we are very excited about Gather for Justice and very excited to be celebrating our 50th anniversary.
And I'm looking forward to watching that interview again. We're talking about, folks, a man who escaped Nazi Germany barely with his life at age 7 with his family, came to the United States, and now at 89 is still at it, still out there working on behalf of Applered. And it's just incredible. So I hope everybody takes a moment to attend Gather for Justice online. Applered Legal Aid Executive Director Robert Johns. Thank you so much, Rob.
Tom, thank you very much. Appreciated the opportunity.
Robert Johns touched on Applered's work in defense of the Red River Gorge, and we're going to get a little more on that now from James Maples, Associate Professor of Sociology here at EKU. Dr. Maples just published Rock Climbing in Kentucky's Red River Gorge, and that fateful turn of events, as well as the growth of an international rock climbing community, are focuses of his work. Welcome, James.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So the book covers a lot of ground where rock climbing in the gorge is concerned, and you've used the history of the region to make the case for climbing as a valuable economic resource. So let's first touch on some of that history. You devote a couple of chapters to something that, had it gone forward, had it happened, would have left us with very little to talk about other than a lake right now. And we're talking about the proposed Red River Dam.
That's right. You know, in the 1960s, there was a strong reason for having a dam, as there really could be argued there's a reason today. And that dam moved forward. You know, there was a lot of flooding in this region over its history. And I think 1963 was about when the Corps of Engineers first proposed to really look at damming the Red to try and prevent some of this flooding that we still see in places like Powell County. That would have involved 3,400 acres that would have been underwater, as well as something like 100,000 acres that would have been developed as part of that process of creating a dam. Arguably, that also may have created a water source for the city of Lexington. That ends up being resisted, however, by national forces. The local community is in support of it, almost wholeheartedly, in fact. But by around 1967, we see the Sierra Club, a national organization, really starting a national level resistance to this dam. Part of that includes the year before that, the founding of the Cumberland chapter of the Sierra Club by Carol Tichenor and several others in 1966. And then this over time leads to a Stop the Dam protest in 67. Of course, there was also the very famous hike by Supreme Court Justice William Douglas that same year that really continued to raise this to the national level. Had this moved forward, it would have flooded this area and changed it dramatically. But by 1969, Louis Nunn, the governor at the time, withdrew his support. Nixon later withdrew his support as well. The dam reappears as a conversation in the early 70s, a little further downstream, but that too ends up being rejected. And that one more so by a much larger contingency of local and non-local forces. President Bush and President Clinton ended up signing legislation that actually protects the Red River Gorge. So now today there will be no dam on the Red River Gorge, or the Red River more specifically. And so we see that climbing is something that has happened alongside of this. In 1969, they have their first registered ascents in the fall of 69 by Ron Stokely, Dieter Britz, and a couple of other folks. And the community has simply just grown and grown over the last 50 years.
Well, why is sport climbing so key to this discussion?
It's really exciting because with the Red River Gorge, we have this really interesting sort of layback climbing opportunity. If you go to any of the crags that we see in the Red and in the surrounding area in places like Lee County, the rock often is in a sort of angle so that it allows you to climb up, but also to climb back. This is nice because when a climber falls, when they swing from the rope, it actually allows them to swing freely as opposed to a place like Yosemite where you sort of cheese grate right down the side of the rock.
Ouch.
But the second part of this was actually, yeah, it hurts. The second half of this is because with the Red River Gorge, so many of the climbing areas don't have natural features where removable protection could be placed. Now, really, up until the 80s, the Red River Gorge is what we would call a trad or traditional climbing destination, meaning that the climbers were using these removable protections that could be put in between wedges of the rock. And, you know, basically, if you were to fall, your rope would be clipped into that and it would stop you there. With the sport climbing that starts popping up in the 1980s and really moving through the 90s and through to till today, we see that climbers actually will drill holes in the rock wall and they will put in permanent bolts that they can then clip into. And again, this will protect them on their ropes as if they fall. The trade-off with this is that the removable protection was exactly that. It could be removed and it would leave limited to no sign that they'd been there. Now, with the sport climbing option, you have to put in a permanent thing that is permanently adhered to that wall. You know, up to this point, all the climbing in the Red was on the Forest Service property, but as sport climbing starts really taking off in the late 80s and early 90s in the Red, the Forest Service starts to become very concerned about these permanent anchors that have now been placed into the wall. And this brings up a whole new question about sport climbing in the Red, in that, you know, how can the Forest Service protect these areas at the same time as we are expanding these routes? So it actually leads to a conversation in 1994 about a climbing ban. And this becomes sort of a proving piece for the entire United States and the Forest Service of how the Forest Service is going to deal with sport climbing.
Where does that stand today, that discussion about the potential impact on the natural areas in the gorge?
The climbers in the Red River Gorge have done a very great job in the recent decade plus of becoming a supporter of the Forest Service and of working within their regulations. This also applies to the national park areas. They've become a good community partner, is my experience of looking through their experiences. And to date, sport climbing is allowed in the Forest Service. 1995 was the climbing management guide, which allowed for the existing sport climbing routes to be continued. It did put limitations on developing new sport routes. So this kind of creates this moment where growth slows down in the Red River Gorge. The bolts also continued to be a problem. The ones that had been previously installed were often installed over indigenous areas, particularly rock shelters, which are all throughout the Red River Gorge. And this ends up coming to a real head in 2000, 2001 at an archaeological dig at Military Wall. And that particular archaeological dig, they end up deciding to close some sport routes that are located right over a particular rock shelter to protect the site underneath. And that was based on the data of the dig that they found there. One of the things that people often don't know about the Red River Gorge is it's first, very deep in indigenous history. But second, it's home to one of these many hearths of food domestication that we see across our species. You know, this was one of the places where we see those early efforts of indigenous people selecting larger seeds and then creating these, you know, gardens and creating these spaces where plants would evolve over time to make bigger and bigger fruits. And so it's very exciting that it was happening right there in the climbing area at Military Wall, but also for that reason, it was something that had to be closed. After that, we start to see a scenario where climbers say, well, if this area can be closed, so can the other areas. So what are we going to choose to do to protect these areas? And two things really exciting happen. The first one is we see climbers take a far more dedicated perspective on protecting the environment. This was something that had occurred in the early days of climbing and was still present, but it had changed slightly over time. There was a focus on route expansion as opposed to protecting the areas. So climbers are now thinking more about limiting their impacts through leave no trace, through making sure trails are established and they're approved by the Forest Service, and that they're not creating, you know, new user trails to areas and damaging the environment. The other side of that is they also decide to become landowners themselves. In fact, following the Military Wall archaeological dig and the partial closure at Military Wall, we see climbers operate two climbing preserves. That would be Muir Valley, which is located in Wolf County, and then that would be the Pendergrass Murray Recreational Preserve, which is located in Lee County. So these operate as these first opportunities where climbers are actually owning the areas that they climb. This slowly but surely leads to what we see today, which is the bulk of climbing in the Red River Gorge is not in the Daniel Boone National Forest or the Red River Gorge geological area. It's actually moved into the surrounding counties, and it continues to expand into new areas all the time.
This proposed resort for the gorge area, there's been a great deal of discussion about it, even some significant preliminary investment toward that end. And I just wondered what you might be hearing in the gorge community about this. Is it welcomed? Are there concerns?
I think it really varies by the person that you're talking to. I'm not sure there's a consensus either way. Mm-hmm. There has been a lot of concern because much of this discussion has occurred during the pandemic. And so I think that has impacted the ability to get information about exactly what is being proposed, you know, to the people in the community and so forth. My personal perspective is I think the proposed resort is probably looking at a different clientele than has really been there in the past. With the Red River Gorge, it's been an outdoor recreation destination for 50 years. It was made famous in part, in fact, by that dam that ended up becoming a national news issue with the Sierra Club resisting the dam. And, you know, climbing is a worldwide sport. And this is a worldwide climbing destination. People from around the world understand what the Red River Gorge is. But I think with the new proposed resort, they may be going after a different clientele, something more akin to maybe Pigeon Forge, Tennessee. And I don't think they're necessarily focused on outdoor recreation. So only time will tell how that is going to come into play. There's also a lot of questions, too, about how the property would be developed and even the specifics of what property B is being developed. Going back to that indigenous issue, I think that is certainly one thing that will have to be considered as they develop these areas, because we have to make sure that these indigenous areas are protected and they're maintained. And depending on the property that's being developed, if it's, you know, in private hands, then that may impact how they choose to pursue that issue.
What do you hope readers of the book are going to take away from it? What do you hope that they learn from it?
I hope that readers can appreciate the history. I think the second part of that is that I hope that the climbing community and local residents can also come to appreciate each other's experiences more. You know, starting with the advent of sort of lifestyle climbing and sport climbing in the 80s and 90s in the Red, I think a wedge was driven further and further between the local community and climbers. If we go back to the 60s, many local residents opposed rock climbing because it appears alongside this Sierra Club protest Mormons. And, you know, the Cumberland Climbers were affiliated with the Cumberland chapter of the Sierra Club. So they were, you know, part and parcel with that. So I think that there was a feeling that climbers were all outsiders. But of course, at that time, we actually know that the climbers were really lots of folks from the Lexington area, many of which were affiliated with the University of Kentucky and the long-standing caving community that still thrives in this area, such as the Bluegrass Grotto. We saw that as lifestyle climbing, though, expanded, that wedge got deeper and deeper. People became concerned and afraid of climbers. And so I think it really tainted how local residents and climbers interacted. That has dramatically changed in the last 5-10 years. And we see these two communities now working closely together. We also see an increase in climbers relocating to places like Betaville and reaching out to the local community to help address things ranging from, you know, helping establish coding camps for kids in Betaville high schools to, you know, just thinking about what tourism growth in the region is going to look like. So I hope that this is a chance for these two communities to come together. As a third one, I would also say I hope that people will come to appreciate the Daniel Boone National Forest and to appreciate the amount of work, sweat, and tears that they put into supporting this extraordinary place, not only the Red River Gorge, but all of the Daniel Boone National Forest. We're truly blessed as Kentuckians to have this amazing space, the Shelpelli Trace, all of these extraordinary areas right at our fingertips. And we have to appreciate what it takes for the Daniel Boone National Forest to put that into perspective. I think my last thing that I hope climbers and climbing organizations will get out of this book is really the focus of my last chapter in the book. The last chapter talks about what we can learn from the history of climbing in the Red River Gorge, where things went well, where things didn't go well. It gives us clear evidence of why climbers and climbing communities need to limit their impacts. They need to be aware of being good public partners with public lands, and generally how they can work better with the local communities. Because the thing that I come to time after time when I talk to climbers in the Red is that they love the Red as it is today. They love the people. They love the culture here. They love the experience of the Red as it is. They are not looking to change that. They are not looking to radically redefine it. In fact, if anything, they fear that. They want to keep this area unchanged. And I think that's something that many local residents feel as well. They want to see this area protected and not radically change it. Most certainly, we don't want to see rural gentrification come through this area and slowly push people out. So I think that hopefully climbers can now become allies with local people in trying to raise up places like Stanton, Wolf County, Betaville, Lee County, and to celebrate this amazing thing that we have right here in our backyard, and that's the Red River Gorge.
All right. How can the book be obtained?
It's available on Amazon. It can also be purchased through the University of West Virginia's Press website. And the release date was September 1st, but it's actually available now.
James Maples, Director of the Division for Regional Economic Assessment and Modeling, EKU Associate Professor of Sociology, and author of Rock Climbing in Kentucky's Red River Gorge from West Virginia University Press. Thank you, James. We appreciate it.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Coming up after the break, Kentucky Poet Laureate Crystal Wilkinson.
I think food is culture. You know, when you food is as much a part of the culture as dialect and landscape and accent.
And we welcome a new content partner. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
This is Tom Musgrave with the Kentucky Arts Council. Coming up in Central and Eastern Kentucky Arts. On September 11th and 12th, the Kentucky Arts Council is partnering with Lexington's Waveland State Historic Site to present the Kentucky Crafted Outdoor Market at Waveland, an outdoor celebration of the best in Kentucky art and craft. See and purchase artwork from Kentucky Crafted artists, hear great tunes from some of the state's best musical acts, enjoy Kentucky-made food and beverages, and much more. Tickets are $5 for adults and can be purchased online or at the event. Visit artscouncil.ky.gov for more information and to purchase tickets. From the Kentucky Arts Council for Eastern Standard, I'm Tom Musgrave.
Eastern Standard continues with Tom Martin.
The enduring sting of an unkind remark can live with you for a lifetime. Art is, for some, a way to deal with that, as Tom Eblen discovers in a conversation with one of Kentucky literature's leading lights.
Crystal Wilkinson is an award-winning novelist, a University of Kentucky English professor, and Kentucky's current poet laureate. Wilkinson grew up on her grandparents' farm on Indian Creek in Casey County, and her vivid and elegant writing often explores the Appalachian experience from a Black perspective. She has been writing poetry for decades and was a co-founder of the Afro-Latian Poets Group, but only now, after 3 award-winning books of stories, has she come out with her first book of poetry. Perfect Black was published this month by the University Press of Kentucky. It has an introduction by Nikki Finney, the newest living inductee into the Kentucky Writers Hall of Fame, and illustrations by Wilkinson's husband, the visual artist and poet Ron Davis. This is a rich, honest, and compelling book that is something of an autobiography. It is charged with emotions from throughout her life, ranging from the delicious joys that came from her grandmother's kitchen to the racism and sexism she experienced growing up in rural Kentucky. Poet Frank X. Walker describes the book this way: "With the same authentic voices that anchor her fiction and twice the personal risks, these poems will hand-wash you in the creek and leave you on the line to dry." Here with us today to talk about Perfect Black is Kentucky's poet laureate, Crystal Wilkinson. Crystal, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Why did you wait so long to publish a poetry book?
Well, I think it has to do with love, really, with love, my love for poetry. Fiction, I think, I can't say that it's easy, but fiction is something that I've been doing for a long time, and I've written poetry too, but my poetry is always, you know, in a box under the bed, metaphorically, you know, in my computer, sort of housed away. And the poets that I love, you know, I've never compared myself to them or even thought that I could aspire to do what they do. But once I sort of decided that I would no longer sort of bifurcate myself, that the poet lived in one part of me and the prose writer lived in the other, then it was an easy decision to make to try to get these out in the world.
Well, it's a good thing you did. Tell us a little about your upbringing in Casey County.
Well, I was raised by my grandparents. My mother suffered from mental illness before I was born, and then postpartum and some other things after I was born. So I was raised by my grandparents on 64 acres of land in Casey County. My grandfather was a tobacco farmer, had a few head of cattle, sold milk, and my grandmother was a domestic worker. So that's where I grew up. Went to Casey County Schools, where myself and my 2 cousins were the only Black students there in the whole school system as I was coming through. So from Head Start or kindergarten all the way up through high school, it was just sort of the 3 of us that matriculated together through school. I was sort of had a freedom to roam my grandparents' land and be in touch with nature, developed a relationship with the land and with the animals that were on the land. And that's kind of how I grew up.
Well, you write a lot about the power of family and ancestors and cultural history in this book. And I especially liked your poems, Heritage and O Tobacco. Do you think that many Kentuckians, both Black and white, appreciate how much history and culture have shaped our lives today?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I think that many of us have long-term connections through our ancestors with Kentucky's hills and valleys and hollers and all the regions. And I think the Knob region is where I'm from. I think that we all have a particular pride, you know, that pride's often shown when you ask somebody where they're from and they're from Kentucky, you know, they're going to identify with that county right away. So right. There's 120 counties and we're all sort of invested in our own county instead of saying a region. We all very powerfully claim, pridefully claim our county. So I think that shows a lot of that regional pride that we have.
Well, you know, there's some deeply personal stuff in this book. Why did you think it was important to share that?
You know, I think I'm the kind of writer who writes through these hard things. And I don't often, while I'm writing, think of of audience right away. Like, I'm thinking about the most powerful way that I can tell this particular truth. So it wasn't really a decision that I made that here I go, I'm about to do this. I think it just sort of happened. And one of the reasons it happened is because I was writing poetry and I was writing prose that was close to the bone and close to the truth, which I do in my fiction as well, but it's always buried. You know, there'd be some thread of the truth sort of buried underneath these characters and lots of fiction layered on. And so this book was frightening for me. You know, it wasn't easy. Once it was compiled together and it was written and I read it through during the editing process, I was like, oh, gosh, I've certainly told the truth here, you know. And so it's not until after it was published, like when I'm, it's harder for me to read from it because I do feel vulnerable. But at the same time, I think that's part of being a writer, not so much just sort of vomiting our pathology, but shaping our experience into art in some way, so that our truth can stand and sort of ripple out to people so they can understand what we've gone through, but also understand themselves and their communities better. And I hope that's what I've done.
Mm-hmm. Well, I love the poem, Dear Johnny P., about encountering a man who had bullied you when you were a girl. I think, you know, all of us have had those people in our lives. Very few of us have a chance to kind of write about them later. But tell us a little about that story.
Yeah, that's a poem that I wrote. It actually appears in Coal Black Voices. So that is a documentary about the Appalachian poets that was filmed, 20 years ago or so. And so it's an old story. My grandparents were still alive when I went home. And, you know, this particular thing happened where I ran into one of the people who had called me all of these racial slurs when I was a child. And here I was an adult and had started, you know, making a name for myself in writing and in my career at the time, which was I was also working in public relations for government. Here in Lexington, I work for the city government. And he knew that. And it was, I'm not so sure if the moment was as powerful for him as it was for me, but it was something that I remembered that would pop up into my memory for a very long time after that. And so I felt compelled to write about it.
Mm-hmm. You write a lot in this book about country food and cooking, and I have to tell you, I was really hungry by the time I finished reading it. But I especially enjoyed the piece, Praise Song for the Kitchen Ghosts. Why is food so important to you, and why do you think it's so important in Kentucky culture generally?
Well, I think food is culture, right? You know, I think that the ways in which we prepare food as Kentuckians is a little bit different than the ways that people prepare food in the Deep South or the North. And then if you, you know, you kind of draw that camera in closer, if you look at the way that food is prepared in Appalachia is different from just Kentucky proper. And then I think if you add a layer of race on it, then it becomes even more specific and even more particular. And so I think food is culture. You know, food is as much a part of the culture is dialect and landscape and accents and all of those things. So it's important to me. And, you know, that particular piece, Praise Song for the Kitchen Ghost, is I just sold a book to Penguin Random House by the same name. That's a deeper exploration of food ways for Black Appalachians, and particularly my family, particularly my matriarchal lineage, going all the way back to slavery and sort of exploring the foods. But that's one way of remembering, right? The smells, the taste of your upbringing.
Well, that's true. And I hope it'll include some recipes.
Oh, yes. Lots of recipes.
Okay, good. Well, one reviewer of this book has noted that in some places you capitalize the personal pronoun and I, and in other places you don't. Is there a reason for that?
Well, that reviewer, I think, hit it on the head that one of the things that there are lots of things about these poems that are for lack of a better definition, sort of old school. You know, if you look at Intozaki Shange and you look at other writers that were writing poetry in the 70s, 80s, in part, it's sort of a nod to them. And I think that it's fairly consistent that I capitalize at the beginning of the sentence, and when it's used inside the sentence, it's a smaller I. So it was sort of a stylistic choice, and also a nod to sort of the legacy of those Black women writers who came before me.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for being with us today. And once again, the book is Perfect Black by Kentucky Poet Laureate Crystal Wilkinson and published by the University Press of Kentucky. Thanks a lot, Crystal.
Oh, thank you.
Tom Eblin interviews on Eastern Standard are provided in partnership with the Carnegie Center for Literacy and Learning. Crystal Wilkinson's book is illustrated by her husband, Ron Davis, and you'll find that collection on our site, esweku.org. Well, I'm really excited to welcome a new content partner to Eastern Standard, The Daily Yonder, published by the Whitesburg-based Center for Rural Strategies. Here to talk about what's in store is Daily Yonder editor Tim Marama. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Tim.
Thank you, Tom. It's great to be with you.
Well, Tim, you're going to become a regular here on Eastern Standard, highlighting Daily Yonder articles that are curated by us for relevance to listeners in Appalachian Kentucky. And we plan to dig more deeply into rural issues by talking with contributing writers to the Daily Yonder about their findings. So if you would, to give our listeners a sense of what they can look forward to, tell us about some of the many coverage topics listed on the Daily Yonder site, which, by the way, is dailyyonder.com. Tell us about those, Tim.
The Daily Yonder covers rural news. We're national in focus. We have a lot of relevant content for Appalachia, and our experience is that rural places have different things in common. So what's happening in Iowa may have an impact or be similar to what the issue is in Eastern Kentucky. We look at healthcare, education, some transportation. We look at kind of quality of life issues, how people use public lands, what's going on in the economy and employment, just a wide range of topics that all come back to small towns and rural areas.
Well, as I mentioned, we're really excited about this partnership. So let's jump right into it. Three topics for this debut segment. The first one we identified is the big one for all of us. That's COVID and some of the big picture trends coming out of Eastern Kentucky and rural Appalachia at large.
Well, we have been tracking this story along with the rest of the media universe for a year and a half. I think a lot of us had sort of hoped that the worst of it was behind us, but our most recent analysis of what's happening in rural America with COVID-19 is that it is definitely resurging, and Kentucky and Eastern Kentucky specifically are part of that. Kentucky is actually getting back closer to where it was in the January surge. The rural rate of infection now is a bit higher in Kentucky than it is in the urban areas of Kentucky. And in my estimation, Kentucky did a little bit better than some of the other rural states in our first couple of surges. This time around, it feels like Kentucky has more in common with where I am in Tennessee and parts of the deeper South than it did initially. And that's essentially, in a nutshell, that's not very good news.
You post a map on the Daily Yonder that shows the situation in rural counties. Is that correct?
That's right. And we break it out by metropolitan and non-metropolitan status as a stand-in for rural and urban. We also look at different regions and death rates and lots of different numbers to help people track. And I did run a little bit on the infection rate in about 23 Eastern Kentucky counties versus what's going on statewide with our last report. And I found that the infection rate is 20, 30, 35% higher in those Eastern Kentucky counties than it is in the state overall. And that the rate of deaths that are occurring each week are about twice the rate in those Eastern Kentucky counties as it is statewide.
Okay. It's important to know, as scary as those numbers sound, we need to know that. So I know that you're also following trends in rural employment, and I'm just wondering, what are you finding there?
Our latest story on employment looked at how things have changed over the past 20 years, a very long-term view, comparing 2000 and 2019 annual employment numbers. And what we found nationally is that kind of the bigger the city, the more likely it was to have increases in employment. And the smaller or more rural the community, the more likely it was to have overall losses in employment. And Kentucky fits that trend, unfortunately. Across the state, during that time period, over roughly 20 years, there was about a 6% increase overall. But in rural areas, there was about a 6% decrease in employment. And looking at Southeast Kentucky generally, we saw that there was a similar 6% decrease in employment over that period. So what we're seeing is kind of a story of two economies, one where there's expansion and growth and increase in population, and that's in more urban areas. And in Kentucky, that's going to be your Lexington and your Louisville and your Northern Kentucky, and a drop in employment and population in more rural areas, such as Eastern Kentucky.
So would you say this is kind of a data-based legacy of the out-migration that we've talked about for so many years?
The out-migration is definitely a historical trend, and it continues. I have not run the new 2020 census number, so I don't know for sure what has happened, but it has not been at the rate that we might have seen, say, in the 50s and 60s, when it seemed like everyone we were related to in Eastern Kentucky was moving to Cincinnati or Detroit for factory jobs, because those jobs essentially are not there in those same numbers. So the out-migration in raw numbers is not as large. Percentage-wise, it might be similar, but the big change has already occurred. And I think what we're seeing now is less of a big historical trend and more of just a large national economic trend of a kind of a gradual movement of people toward metropolitan areas where more jobs are.
Okay, and that third topic that we wanted to touch on for this debut conversation has to do with the region's needs for rural infrastructure, transportation, and so on, and how new federal spending might help solve some of those problems. What are you seeing there?
Well, infrastructure, you know, whether you're talking about culverts and gravel from the county judge executive on up to interstate highways and, you know, cross state tunnels. Infrastructure is always a big topic in Eastern Kentucky and Kentucky generally. The infrastructure funding that may be coming down the pike once Congress gets the two versions of the bill resolved, there are things that could make significant difference. There's money for highways and bridges, which is always a big popular point in more rural areas. There's also funding for broadband, which has become sort of the highway of modern work, is having that broadband capability to telecommute. And that could have a significant impact because we do know that our rural counties in Eastern Kentucky and elsewhere in the U.S. have less broadband connectivity than our urban neighbors. And there are things that maybe have less impact. There's public transit funding and railroad funding, passenger rail. You know, we won't see as big an impact probably in Kentucky as other areas might see. The other thing to mention is, I think, highway safety. You know, those of us who've driven the Eastern Kentucky roads, those are by and large two-lane roads. Those are the most dangerous roads in the nation. And the more we can do to add safety features and improve those highways, the safer our travelers will be. And we're far more likely to have fatalities on these country roads than we are in cities. So that could make a difference.
Well, Tim, as you know, our station, WEKU, reaches both rural and urban listeners in central and eastern Kentucky. I know that you often make that connection as well as its disconnection in some of your content. Talk to us about that as an editorial strategy.
Well, we know from an economic standpoint that there's an interrelationship between rural and urban areas, and although a lot of our jobs are kind of migrating toward the cities, that our urban centers do better when they're surrounded by healthier rural areas. And likewise, you know, in eastern Kentucky, there's a benefit there when the bluegrass is doing better. So there's an interrelationship. And I think that that's true from a news standpoint. It's true culturally. And most of us don't have to dig back too many generations, if at all, to find that rural connection. You know, we might have spent summers visiting our grandparents on the farm or in a country setting. We have this traditional connection to it, and it's part of kind of our American DNA. So there's this cultural affinity between rural and urban. And the other part of it is that when there are difficulties, we see a lot of similarities in the economic numbers between large cities, what's happening there with poverty rates and employment, and what's happening in rural areas. So there's an affinity there that goes very deep. And we think that everyone can benefit by understanding more about what other parts of the country are going through. And that's what our strategy is at the Daily Yonder. And we know that, you know, from Richmond and Lexington, that's part of who we are as Kentuckians, is seeing that relationship that we have to other parts of the state, family, vacation, cultural.
All right. That's Tim Merrima, editor of the Daily Yonder, with the first of what will be a monthly visit here on Eastern Standard to talk about what the Yonder's team of contributing writers all across the country are finding as they dig into the issues of rural life in America. Thanks so much, Tim.
Thank you, Tom.
That wraps up this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Wendy Barnett, producer, Neil Kesterson, producing engineer and audio editor, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. You can listen to editions of Eastern Standard on air, online, and on mobile at weku.org or esweku.org, on the WEKU mobile app, or as a podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. Want to suggest an interview or a topic? Drop us a line at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.